This is Ben Smith from Politico.com, from Politico's headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, talking to Ari Berman of The Nation in New York. We're going to be talking today about an incendiary story he did on Obama campaign manager Jim Messina and some other things, but I think we're going to start with the news of the day in Washington, which is the battle over the Ryan budget, and particularly what looks like it could be an approaching government shutdown. And what's the view from Moscow and the Hudson, Ari?
Well, it's very gray and rainy here, just like Moscow, Ben, befitting our reputation. For the longest time, I felt like there wasn't going to be a government shutdown. This was all just posturing by both sides to try to get the best deal. In the last day or so, though, I'm not really sure if that's the case anymore, because this figure that seemed to be agreed upon of $33 billion in cuts now seems inoperable. It really seems like John Boehner doesn't believe that he can get his Republican colleagues in the House to agree with him, that he can never get them to agree with Harry Reid on anything, and thus there will be a de facto government shutdown because the Tea Party is just never going to agree to any sort of deal. That's certainly the doomsday scenario. Now, I still think in the back of my mind they're going to cut some kind of deal because the politics of this are bad for both sides. How does it look down in Washington?
Can they really be bad for both sides? It's a zero-sum game, isn't it?
If you look at the polling,
do you not think the politics of this are good for your side?
If you look at the polling, it looks bad for both sides. I mean, I just think that this is going to reinforce a notion that Washington is ungovernable, which is going to hurt Republicans and Democrats alike. It's going to drag everybody down, my feeling. I don't think this is going to be like 1995 where one side has a clear advantage over the other. You see it differently?
Yeah, I think it's only good for Donald Trump. No, just joking. I mean, I don't know. I think what you're definitely right that there's this perception, which Boehner, I think because it's true, has really benefited from, that he can't control his caucus. And so he can go back, he can go to the president and say, look, I can't, you know, it's not up to me. These crazy guys aren't going to compromise. And that gives him a huge amount of leverage that Obama doesn't have. Obama, you know, has not wanted to fight the way Bill Clinton fought last time, to see this as just an all-out kind of tactical war. He finally went on TV today and engaged. But at this point, quite late in the day, he hasn't chosen to sort of define himself around this budget fight and to make it the kind of moral issue that I think a lot of his supporters would like.
Which I find really surprising, because you think the budget would be a perfect opportunity for him to talk about his economic agenda and contrast it with that of the GOP. But that message has really been lost. I mean, Obama has retreated into the background, and this has basically been a conversation about cuts. Whose cuts do you think are better? The Democrats' cuts, which are thought of as more of a scalpel approach, or the GOP's cuts, which are thought of as more sweeping? But this is still a discussion about cuts, which I think plays to the Republicans' advantage.
What would you like him to say instead?
I mean, I would like him to say, here is my plan to create jobs. Here is my plan to get the economy moving again. And in terms of talking about the debt, if we're going to talk about it, we have to talk about it in the context of how it fits into our economic recovery. Instead, what I think he's doing is I think he's saying, okay, I agree we need to cut. I agree with you guys. I just disagree on how to get there. And that's a two-step message. And I think that nuance in the Obama message is being lost on the American people, because the Republicans have a very simple message, which we need to cut, cut, cut. And the Democrats, I don't think, have done a very good job of pointing out what the effect of those cuts would be.
Yeah, I mean, I think Obama's political team, to some degree, has lost faith in, you know, the idea that liberalism, that progressivism could sell the way they thought it could in the first 2 years, that these programs would kind of vindicate themselves. And so I think, yeah, you're seeing, I mean, you know, Mark Penn wrote a column today in Huffington Post that I imagine had a lot of folks kind of, you know, just up in arms a bit, in which he said that Obama ought to be shadow boxing himself, and that's what the president should be doing right now, is not fighting the Republicans, but fighting his own image as a big spending liberal. But to some degree, that does seem to be what he's doing.
Yeah, that's what he's doing. That's what's funny. I mean, Penn, we can talk about him later. My feeling is he is a one-note, one-man band. He always says the same thing over and over again, which is that whoever politician he's advising needs to move to the center. And I would argue that the Obama administration has been and is in the political center. One of the problems that they had in the last few years is they didn't make a case for their own spending for the things they did. So, for example, we saw this in the stimulus fight. You know, 95% of Americans got a tax cut in the stimulus, but only 8% knew about it. So that's the kind of thing where if the administration's not communicating what they've done on the recovery, it makes it a lot harder to them go out and say, okay, we need to spend this more money. We need to invest in these government programs to try to get us out of it. Do you basically think the Penn advice has now become conventional wisdom in Washington?
I mean, I think Bill Daley was of that camp all along, warning that healthcare was too big and too left-wing. And Bill Daley has been of that camp, you know, for decades, really, thinking that the Democratic Party needs to sort of – the Democratic leadership needs to sort of actively resist its liberal interest groups. And so the choice of Daley and the whole sort of second-term agenda, I don't know if, you know – they would hate. They would loathe the idea that Mark Penn was in some way influencing it. But it is certainly closer to that Clinton, you know, that Clinton second 2 years playbook. And although I think they, I mean, I think they're sort of going more for above the fray than the sort of active center right Clinton. I mean, what they're looking for here is just sort of an above-the-fray president, which is getting quite tough as the fray in Washington really gets very intense.
Yeah, not only that, but the Clinton example is more complicated than a lot of the conventional wisdom has it, because not only did Clinton move to the right and quote-unquote triangulate on a lot of issues, as you know, but he also fought the Republicans and picked his battles wisely. And one of the main places he fought them was on the budget, right, where he talked about protecting Medicare, protecting Medicaid, protecting energy and the environment, the sort of M2E2 formula. And Obama hasn't seemed to show a similar willingness to lay down the marker. Now, today he rejected the GOP's plan, so maybe he's digging in a little bit, but he hasn't sort of broadly set up the spending fight with the Republicans like Clinton did and really engaged in a showdown with Boehner. He's much less willing to do that than I think Clinton was.
Yeah, I was talking to a former Clinton aide today who was saying, you know, for all that they knock us for being kind of center-right and compromisers, or center-left, or whatever we were, you know, we were fighters, and Clinton gleefully went to war with Newt Gingrich over the budget repeatedly, and, you know, and basically, in retrospect, looks like he won those fights in a way that Obama has not wanted to just to turn this into a defining fight which puts him on one side and the Republicans on the other.
No, Obama just seems like he wants to cut a deal and get on to the next topic, because I think he's worried, justifiably so, that if he doesn't get some sort of deal, it's really going to hurt him because he'll be viewed as not having control of Washington and will become, instead of a Clinton-esque figure, much more of a Carter-esque figure, not really being in control of his own party or his own government. So that's why I think they want to strike a deal. They don't want to strike an egregious deal, but I still think they want to strike a deal at the end of the day. I think more so than the Republicans who are influenced by the Tea Party do.
Anyway, speaking of another topic, you wrote a piece about Jim Messina, Obama's campaign manager, probably the first many people had ever heard of the guy, that really touched off a very entertaining sequence of events in Washington. But I guess, you know, I would love to first of all return to the substance of the piece, which is, you know, why are people on the left uncomfortable with this guy?
Yeah, well, I guess unbeknownst to many people in Washington, there was a fourth war launched this week, which, as you chronicled, was the war to define Jim Messina, which I guess I'm guilty of starting.
You fired the first shot.
I fired the first shot. I had heard a lot of things about Messina for a pretty long time. I mean, dating back at least to the early 2000s when I was doing more reporting on Max Baucus, saying this guy's a pretty powerful operative. He's made a lot of enemies, but no one's really looked at him yet. And so that's why, knowing that he would become Obama campaign manager, I wanted to look at the substance of, you know, who is Jim Messina? What has he done in the White House? What has he done working for Max Baucus? What will that tell us, if anything, about the campaign that Obama will run in 2012? And my feeling was Messina was a very powerful guy most people hadn't heard of. And his career, in part, was marked by his clashes with progressives on issues, for example, in the administration, like healthcare, like gay rights, two issues that he worked on, and that these clashes were pretty noteworthy, and in a way, he was functioning as a deputy of sorts, a Rahm Emanuel-like character, and then when Rahm left, obviously he didn't assume the role of Rahm because Rahm is bigger than life, but he took on that role of an enforcer for the administration. And I thought that raised some interesting questions about the kind of job he was going to do on the 2012 campaign. So that was how the first shot got fired. And then, of course, there was a lot of frantic pushback by the administration. But I think it's been, on the whole, I think a pretty good discussion to have.
I mean, I guess, you know, my objection to the piece to some degree was not that you got anything wrong, but that why would anybody think Jim Messina was making these decisions? He was implementing and trying to handle the politics around decisions that were going to make the gay and lesbian community and some healthcare advocates unhappy. But why blame him? Like, he's really just the messenger here, no?
To an extent, I mean, the piece is called Obama's Enforcer, so I make it pretty clear who Messina is working for. I also think it's telling, though, that Messina spent so many years working for Max Baucus and then spent 2 years working for Rahm Emanuel. I mean, I don't think it was a coincidence that Messina was working under Rahm and that Rahm wanted Messina to work under him. He was, to an extent, carrying out what the administration wanted. But I also think if you look at his relationship with progressive activists on healthcare reform, for example, or his relationships with progressive activists on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I mean, if there had been a different person in that position, there might not have been as much tension. I mean, Messina was very much reflecting the Rahm Emanuel view in the Obama White House, which you could just say was Obama's point of view. But as we know, there were divides in the White House over a lot of issues on policy matters. And Messina was often on the side of those arguing in favor of the inside strategy, arguing against progressive activists. So regardless if he was or was not just carrying the president's water, I still think that's interesting in terms of what it tells us about what 2012 will look like, because if he has Obama's blessing to operate this way, then I think we're going to see that the 2012 campaign will look a lot different than the 2008 campaign, which was inevitable anyway, but perhaps even more
and
broadly.
And where Messina was the deputy campaign manager, right? Who, I mean, he was Plouffe's right hand. He was very central to the 2008 campaign, wasn't he?
Well, he came in late. He came in June 2008 when the Obama campaign was just ramping up for the general election as the campaign's chief of staff. And he really made sure that the trains would run on time. He wasn't a central strategist or a central advisor. So I think he'll have a much larger portfolio now than he did before. I was interested, I saw your piece today about this, or maybe it came out last night, where you said that Plouffe and Axelrod will essentially be running the campaign like they ran last time. And I'm actually wondering about that because I've heard some people say that too. But if David Plouffe is in the Situation Room dealing with Libya, right? And if he's
nobody's
in budget meeting
David
with John
Plouffe,
Boehner.
I don't think anybody's going to be you know, sending David Plouffe in to bomb Libya. I think they have
other people
for that.
So you don't think that he's involved in all sorts of senior White House discussions?
No, of course he is. But I mean, I think it would be foolish to think that the president ultimately is not a utterly political animal who's obsessed with politics, who's obsessed with his campaign, like virtually every politician who is, you know, has a very intense personal interest in getting himself a second term. And so I think, I mean, this is every reelect since, you know, the late days of the John Adams campaign. He moved into the White House in November, the like last couple of days of his 1800 campaign. I mean, is going to be run to a large degree out of the White House. The big decisions, the big strategic questions are going to be Obama talking to Plouffe and calling Messina and saying, here's what we decided. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, I do think Messina will have an expanded role and a broader role, but there's a wide expectation. I mean, but it's managing the president's reelection is just not the same thing as managing.
But that's what he was doing in the White House also. And he still had a very important portfolio, and he was still put in charge of a lot of important things. So even if he wasn't carrying
out
these decisions,
you know, it's not like he was saying like, we gotta really screw the gay rights people this week. I mean, it was like they had made that decision, and he was the one who had to try to, you know, he was basically the guy who had to like show up at the meeting and get yelled at.
I think he was doing both. I think that you're understating his role a little bit.
You know, I'm going to argue to the death on Jim Messina's behalf in the hopes that he will leak me tidbits of information as the campaign proceeds.
It's too late for you since you already made your infamous blog post, The Messina Wars. The mere mention of his name may be viewed as taking sides.
No, I do think – I mean, I think there's something to it. He's clearly not of the – he's not a man of the left. He's not a – He's not somebody who came up in the sort of progressive ranks. Neither, though, is virtually anyone around Obama. I mean, David Axelrod really did come up, I guess, on the left in Chicago in a certain way. But Plouffe was a Capitol Hill political operative, just like Messina. And most of the people who, I mean, you know, Dan Pfeiffer, the communications director, had worked for Evan Bayh. I mean, these are professional Democratic political mm-hmm. types. These are not movement progressives, by and large, surrounding him.
No, I mean, what was interesting about Plouffe was that he was a very conventional figure who then ran a much more unconventional campaign because he was running against the Clintons, and he knew if he just ran a second-rate version of the Clinton campaign, he would lose. Now, I think the incentives to be...
Yeah, I'd suggest that was not like a moral progressive decision necessarily.
No, it wasn't. It was a tactical decision, but it made him more open to grassroots politics than he might have otherwise had been. I think that seems to be
right. And Messina didn't come up as a grassroots guy. I think you underestimated to some degree how central he was just to the operation of the 08 campaign. He came in a bit late, but he came in. But his job was really just to run steer the shit, to mechanically run the thing, and so he was very deep in the weeds. But I think it's an interesting conversation. It's also, I mean, it seems to me it's just like the typecasting of Rahm Emanuel, which was also not untrue. It's to some degree about sort of staking out a way for people on the left to try to pull Obama in their direction and to kind of set down a marker, right? To say you're watching. Or is that tactical?
With Messina, I think he just reflects how things are different. I mean, Obama is the establishment candidate now. He is of the establishment. He is surrounded even more so in 2008 by very establishment type figures. And thus, someone like Messina fits into his calculations much better than he might have in 2008. And so I'm not necessarily saying that Messina represents a perversion of where Obama is today. I think he's a reflection of where Obama is today.
All right, I think I lost you here. Are you still here?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep. I was just going to ask you, I mean, you were kind of shocked and appalled by some of the reaction to your story, and you thought it exposed some stuff about Washington media. What did you think it exposed?
Well, I wasn't surprised that some prominent journalists and some prominent Democratic operatives quickly defended Messina after my piece came out. I don't know to what extent that was coordinated by the Obama campaign or by DNC people or not. What I thought was surprising was just not necessarily surprising, but what made me a little irritated was just this front page story in the New York Times about Messina, which I just thought was very substance free. Whether you like or dislike the guy, it didn't really get into what he's done, who he is. There was a lot of what I viewed as trivial details and a lot of just discussions about strategy without any sort of context about it. And that seemed to me like the classic, what they call a beet sweetener story. Jonathan Alter wrote in 1988 about this process whereby powerful journalists write positive stories about up-and-coming or established political figures as a way to try to get them to tell them more stuff and to leak more good stuff to them on their beat. And I viewed the Zeleny piece as kind of a classic beet sweetener. Now, I don't know if you disagree with me on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, I mean, on one hand, I think there's a great tradition of beet sweeteners. And obviously, I mean, remember when I first was covering New York City Hall, my editor said, you know, first thing you do, just go out and write profiles of a bunch of people. You know, not necessarily glowing profiles, but just talk to them, ask what they have to say, and print it, you know, like just non-judgmental, straightforward profiles, and that this is a great way to get to know the beat and to make contacts. And, you know, I mean, this is as old as reporting. I mean, I don't know about that, but it's a very old reporting method, is you just sort of start by profiling the relevant people. And I think I saw the Zeleny story in that light more. I mean, I didn't think it was a grotesque beat sweetener, because it's very easy to tilt from that into just a favor to somebody that comes across as ludicrous, and I guess I did think that the context that you're writing about, the tensions between Messina and some people on the left, probably belongs in any story about him. But I don't know. I guess I felt I'd seen worse. But I did think the way in which, I mean, there was sort of a reaction to your story, it gave people an opportunity to say, you know, I'm with you, Jim. So, you know, like, you know, I want an appointment in the second term, or, you know, whatever it is. Just like, here's, I'd like a chit, please. Because, and that, this is true for both reporters and for people who aren't reporters, that, like, this is sort of an economy. So I did think you were probably noticing, you were noticing something there for sure.
Well, and the thing about the time space, I think it's a little different than, for example, you starting out on a job and profiling a bunch of people, because this is going to be the most read piece on him. This is going to be the first that people have heard about him. A lot of people, I mean, obviously a number of people have seen my story before it came out and it got a lot of attention, but nonetheless, the Times has the widest reach of any paper. And what you would assume is that they would at least dig into, I'm not necessarily even the critique of him on the left, but just dig into, you know, who is this guy? What is his background? What has he done? What issues has he worked on? How is he perceived by people? I mean, I thought all of that was largely missing from the piece, and that's why it was surprising. So I had more issues, for example, with that piece than I did with Mark Ambender of the National Journal defending Messina, because my feeling was Ambender, even though I disagree with where he comes out on things, now Ambender just legitimately believes that Messina is on the right in terms of these issues. Where with the Times, I questioned what's their motivation here a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think there'll be a lot of there are going to be so many column inches written, or whatever they, what they used to call column inches written on the on this campaign. There'll probably be space for both. But I do think, I mean, I think, you know, Jack Schaefer is always calling out beet sweeteners, and it does seem like a valuable service.
Well, I mean, but the funny thing is, this is what Alter talked about, his 1988 column, is that does it really lead to a valuable endgame? Because Alter pointed out when he was covering the Washington Press Corps that the Washington Press Corps often missed the biggest stories. They were not the ones to break Watergate. They were not the ones to break Iran-Contra, because they were so obsessed with mingling and cozying up to their powerful sources that they weren't looking around at all of the scandals. They weren't holding them accountable to the degree that they could have been, and they thus missed some of the biggest stories. So I mean,
beet sweeteners are kind of a symptom of that. I'm glad you're keeping it real in New York there. I'll be headed back to Brooklyn tonight to avoid. I try not to sleep here, because, you know, you pick up that kind of those social aspirations. You got to watch
out.
Well,
I reported in D.C. for 2 years, and one of the reasons I left was for this very reason, which is I just found it all to be a little bit too incestuous. Not to, that has obviously no commentary as D.C. versus New York as a city, because I'm sure we're both firmly on the side of New York.
Oh, I feel like it's sort of tired to pick on poor D.C.
It's a tired debate, especially since we both live in New York and we can rest our heads.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there are a lot of great reporters in D.C., and I mean, it's partly just about your attitude and whether you would rather your sources, you know, respect you and occasionally dislike and even slightly fear you, or whether you want them to love you. And I don't know.
I'm not trying to pretend like I'm some saintly character. I don't worry about what people think about me when I write articles.
As you were saying in email, you have the with a Nation brand comes with a whole bunch of sources, like the grease is built in.
Well, it's interesting. It isn't, though, because I feel like I'm often reporting fairly critically about progressive groups and progressive organizations, and I get a fair amount of blowback. And even when I was doing this Messina article, it wasn't like the progressive activists, even some of whom were critical of him, were rushing to talk to me. I mean, a lot of those people didn't really want to talk to me either for the story. Some of them begrudgingly
did.
Was
there any coordinated effort to spin you? Did they send a bunch of progressive activists your way in the end to say how great he was?
They sent some. I mean, I was in touch with him trying to get an interview for a long time, wanting to be able to interview him. And I would have given him, you know, as much space as was allowed, basically, to be able to have him tell his side of the story. They didn't want to do that. They did steer me to some people to talk to. Some of them, quite frankly, I had already talked to. So it wasn't like I was trying to ignore them or anything. But I also know that, you know, they have their agenda. And us as reporters, we don't have the same agenda that they have. Even, you know, as a progressive-minded reporter like myself, I mean, I still view it as my job to try to hold both sides accountable. So I wasn't that concerned at the end of the day what they thought about the piece.
Reasonable.
Let's talk about, I think, Ben, I want to, before we go, be able to talk about some of your stories. If we've exhausted that one, I want to jump to another interesting story. I don't think we can really call it a beet sweetener. I think it fell more in the color variety, which is John Huntsman and his prog rock band.
Hang on one second. I have to explain to an editor that I'm doing blogging heads. Hi, Bill. This happens when you work in a normal newsroom. Sorry. Should I try to avoid? But John Huntsman.
Ben, what can you tell us about John Huntsman's rock band? Why did that story interest you? How did you come across it?
Well, you know, I think this is actually
– little piece.
I think this is sort of a fun season to write about who these guys actually are before they've managed to get – you know, they've had operatives lock down every sibling and distant cousin and high school friend and explain to them that it's terrible to talk to the press. And yeah, John Huntsman, who's thinking of running for president, has a very unusual personal story in that he dropped out of high school to play in a progressive rock band. I'm actually sort of modeling a John Huntsman hairstyle today in his honor.
Yeah, that's going to take it might take you a year or two to be able to do that.
It's been a while since I had a haircut. It's not good. He thought that like this was going to be his ticket. He and his bandmates, you know, they rehearsed 5 hours a day. They, they played, top Salt Lake City venues. But there was this idea of this. It's a phrase still used out there, but for in the rock scene then specifically, they talked about the Zion Curtain, as meaning that no Utah band could ever get out. And eventually, a couple of the band members headed out to Los Angeles to try to make it big. To me, actually, the most interesting thing in the piece, though, was that Salt Lake is a pretty divided society between Mormons and non-Mormons. And the band actually had three non-Mormons and two Mormons in it, which was unusual in itself. And the non-Mormons were very non-Mormon. They were going out to the parking lot to get stoned every day during rehearsal. And so it was pretty and Huntsman and his drummer, Howard Sharp, who's now an obstetrician, didn't touch the stuff, according to their bandmates, never inhaled, but were kind of willing to be in that milieu and didn't, and sort of straddled a line that is actually apparently pretty unusual for people to sort of to walk that line and to be in both places and to be a devout Mormon, but at the same time be, playing progressive rock with stoners all day.
And how do you think Huntsman fits into the 2012 field? I mean, he clearly seems like a very formidable candidate who's never going to make it through a Republican primary.
Yeah, I think that's about it. I mean, he's a very formidable general election candidate. He's sort of prima facie a serious person if he shows up at debates. I mean, he's not a former senator who got shellacked. He's not a former CEO of a pizza company. He's the very successful Republican governor of a very conservative state who, is leaving basically the country's most sensitive diplomatic post. And so I think he's going to be taken seriously as a serious guy.
What's the end goal for him, though?
There's talk in his circle openly. His chief fundraiser said, his brother said, maybe 2016 is the year. I think, maybe this is sort of a practice run for 2016. I think there's the scenario in which he wins is in which Obama looks extremely strong all of a sudden, and the Republican Party panics and decide they need somebody who's electable. This never works. I mean, it's very hard to win a primary saying, I know you don't like me, but I'm the electable guy. But it does seem like that's the strategy.
Isn't that Mitt Romney's message anyway?
No, Mitt Romney's message is I'm really conservative. Mitt Romney's message is, I didn't used to be conservative, but now I am totally conservative. And Huntsman's message is going to say, look, I'm conservative. You can, he has a pretty conservative record. He was the Republican governor of Utah. He didn't have to govern a state like Massachusetts or Minnesota where you'd have pressure from the left. That context is helpful to him. But having worked for Obama is really very hard to get around. And I don't really see how he gets around it, although he'll certainly be entertaining to cover. I think at a foreign policy moment, it'll be fun to cover a guy who, has spent a lot of time thinking about foreign policy. I just don't know how the media seems his natural constituency here, and I don't quite know how he gets beyond that.
And I don't know, do you have any indication of what he's going to talk about? Like, is he going to actually go after Obama? I mean, where does he substantively disagree with Obama? How will he explain why he served in the Obama administration?
You know, I think if he emerges with a, I think if he emerges with a really strong critique of Obama's foreign policy, if he said, you know, I was in China and we, and like, we're losing China because of Obama and here are the six reasons why. And I mean, I think that's something that will at least be taken seriously and listened to and be interesting. I mean, he certainly is a guy who's been in a position to see and think about Obama's foreign policy quite a bit. Unfortunately, he's also been executing it. It's, I don't really – it's very hard
to see how he gets around. Do you actually think that's what he – I mean, I guess we just don't know if he even believes that.
We have no idea what he believes. He's in China, like kind of at least allowing this shadow campaign to go forward while he continues to serve as ambassador, which poses all sorts of complicated legal questions. I mean, he's in violation of federal law if he coordinates with them or tells them to do things on his behalf.
Yeah, that's why it's been surprising to see so much stuff leak out about his role while he's still over there. On the other end of the spectrum, we saw a Time story that I liked a little bit better about how Michelle Bachmann might win Iowa. Do you see that as actually a possible scenario, and what would that actually do to the Republican race?
You know, Pat Robertson won Iowa. There's a space in Iowa, maybe a 20 to 40% space, 20 to 30%. For particularly folks out west who are really motivated by social conservatism, it's not enough just to be with them on the issues. It's got to be the only thing you talk about, or at least the primary thing you talk about. There's space for somebody to do that. I mean, what it basically, in a certain way, what it does is it hurts a social conservative with a broader appeal who might be able to move forward out of Iowa and sort of build on that, like a Tim Pawlenty, because it. Because you win Iowa, but it doesn't make you it doesn't make you the nominee. It just means you're the social conservative who won Iowa. And in a way, it undercuts a social conservative who would have a shot at the nomination. I think that's in a certain way, I mean, there's sort of a backhanded way in which it helps Mitt Romney.
Well, I wonder about that. I mean, the Iowa Republican Party has moved, even by its standards, to the right recently. I mean, social conservatives have taken over the channels of the party. Because of the gay marriage decision, social issues are still a very big deal there, more so than in other states. If someone like Bachmann is running really strong or looks to be running really strong, do you think Romney's just going to say to hell with Iowa and just basically skip the state and go to New Hampshire and elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think it allows Romney to say, you know what, this was sort of controlled by a sort of smaller wing of the party that doesn't matter. But Iowa's not that straightforward, you know. The governor is Terry Branstad, who beat back a strong conservative challenge in his primary to win.
Yeah.
This guy named Bob Vanderplatz, who really campaigned. So, you know, it's a complicated place. I mean, the Republican Party infrastructure is not run by social conservatives. And in fact, the Tea Party sort of is just a complicated place because there's this church-based social conservative network that isn't identical to the Tea Party, but is a lot stronger than it would be in other states, and in a way detracts from there being a parallel from the Tea Party being the only force on the right. It's just a more complicated picture out there, and the party leaders, notably the governor, you know, are people who are distrusted by social conservatives.
So you still think Romney is going to put in a full effort there?
You know, he's going to have to. His whole trick is to not look like he's sweating while simultaneously pulling off a great coup or coming as close to that as he can. Realistically, you know, finishes second or third, does a little better than expected, downplays expectations, and then crushes in New Hampshire. I think that's basically the plan.
Yeah, I mean,
and so he'd like the he would like the most
the McCain scenario.
The most unelectable social conservative to pull out New Hampshire. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So and, Romney's rooting for Michelle Bachmann
on that note,
right now.
As Romney and the readers of the nation are rooting for Michelle Bachmann, I think. But it's been good
talking
to you, Ari.
At least there's conversion somewhere. Absolutely. Thank you.